to use certain antennas, but he also gave a physical dimension of the antennas and the frequencies that those antennas are working for. And some of them worked at 3.5 megahertz, which is 80 meters, and some of them 1.8. So the permeability of the thread is also included there, and it gives you a very much professional information. But it was still from the perspective of the practical use. And I was looking for something that is more of a not really scientific, but a complex story about the ferrites in antennas loop, antennas for low frequencies, and I found CIA paper. The paper was released, it's called Declassified, in part, Sanitized Copy Approved for Release, year 2012, 04/10. So that would be quite new articles, I thought. But we know that there is a need of a certain amount of years before CIA or federal government is releasing some of the papers. We know that a few days ago, the papers in regards to the Kennedy assassination were also released. Didn't say much, but they were. So the article is from February 15, 1957, and was released in 2012. It gives you a complete compendium of the work of the famous, good, approved, and guys working for the military. I sent you the copy of that paper, I assume. Yes, I believe, yeah. And I'm not going to go into it, but it's a sanitized copy approved for release, CIA, and the number, and the date, and it says, discussion of air core criterion and ferrite coil length, induced voltage, signal to thermal noise ratio conclusions. And that's only one of the paragraphs. We have some other guys. At the end of it is a number of companies or scientific entities that were hired by CIA to do the work for them. It gives antennas equations, comparison of atmospheric noise and thermal noise in loops antennas at very low frequencies. I wonder what was so important for CIA to pay for it. There was a comparison of induced voltages and signal to thermal noise ratios in ferrite and air core antennas. So, in part, that CIA paper is very much similar to the paper of the Lloyd Butler VK5BR. The only thing is that the CIA paper is giving you a complete, good piece of information checked and approved. I know what Dr. Roy is going to say, but I'm going to give him a chance to criticize it. Then, here are the parts, is comparison of tuned and untuned antennas. So how do they behave if they are untuned, not in resonance? On the sensitivity basis and on a signal to thermal noise basis for broadband antennas and narrowband antennas, the e-field pickup, the experimental methods and results, the schematics, and the experimental analytics of the results. So it is a quite good story. Now I'm in microphone to Dr. Roy before I go further.
AC2GS. Well, I wish I could tell you that I could completely read, digest, and figure out what's going on with a PDF that's about 60 pages and about 12 different illustrations and about 150 different formulas, but that's probably going to take me a little bit more time than the 3-4 minutes that I've looked at it. For the purpose of spreading it about, you can, anyone out there can go to my link page, and either right now or in 1 or 2 minutes, it'll be available for you to grab it from the internet and read it yourself. I don't think the CIA has given us incorrect information. Interpretations might be a little archaic. Understandings about electromagnetism have kind of drifted over the last 50, 60 years, but for all intents and purposes, I assume the information is reasonable. I got cut off. Okay, I will say it again. I looked at it. It's a large PDF. I have put it up on my link page. People can type in roy.ac2gs.com, and the third entry at the very beginning, ferrite antennas for very low frequencies. You can download them, look at them at your leisure. I assume that for all intents and purposes, it's a legitimate article on the subject with legitimate equations and comments. The nuances might have changed a wee bit in as far as describing what's going on in the last 60 plus years of advancement in the field, but otherwise I don't have anything initially problematic to it.
Just as a teaser, I'm giving you some quote from the conclusions from just one small part of it. It's archaic, but it's to the point, completely on the money. As a result of the preceding discussion, some conclusions are reached regarding the respective merits of ferrite core VLF receiving antennas, viz. In general, the ferrite core antenna is compatible to an air core antenna only if its maximum dimension is permitted to be somewhat larger than 1.2 to 1.8 times. I have a problem with that. Then air core antenna diameter, okay, so it's permitted then somewhat larger than 1.2 to 1.8 times than the air core antenna diameter. The print is not quite easy to read, but you can read it. The practical value of replacing an air core antenna with the ferrite antenna depends upon the value that can be placed upon the difference in the geometry of the two antennas in specific receiver. Aside from the physical packaging of an antenna, the line geometry of ferrite antenna permits the reduction of stray capacity, well, stray capacitance should be, to the chassis and hence a reduction of E-field pickup. Furthermore, the E-field shielding of the line geometry is somewhat simpler than shielding an air core loop. The problem of winding high impedance antennas, that's interesting. That's extremely interesting. Because we don't have to deal only with 50 ohms or 75 ohms or the 600 ohms like some of the transmission lines are giving us. So the problem of winding high impedance antennas determined by maximum permissible inductance and yet maintaining the highest possible Q distributed capacity is simpler for the coil geometry of the ferrite antenna than for the coil geometry of the air core antenna. I'm wondering because I have a number of links that I found with ready to use and ready put to buy ferrite antennas for VLF. I'm not going to promote the sellers, but they are fairly inexpensive antennas. I also got some information about the German-made ferrite antennas. I wonder why Ham Radio didn't want it to take advantage of ferrite antennas for 3.5 megahertz and for 1.8 megahertz, Dr. Roy.
KG2RY.
Yes, David, you want to make a comment?
Yes, I want to ask both of you a question. You have the word inductance, the word inductance. If you had to draw a picture of what inductance should look like, what would be your take on it?
Okay, interesting question. Never really thought about it. The way that I think of inductance is electrical energy is either stored as electrostatic charge or a magnetic field. Capacitors store it in an electrostatic field. Inductors store it in a magnetic field. So I perceive it as a length of conducting wire, for the most part, that concentrates a given magnetic field locally.
You know me?
You'll have a wire with magnetic field around it. What would that picture look like?
Well, I hate to be redundant, but it would look like a wire with a magnetic field around it.
Now, would the magnetic field be just a blur, kind of like a fog, or would it be some light coming off of the wire, or would it be something else?
Well, the usual way of illustrating it is by using so-called field lines. You have seen magnetic field lines every time you've taken a permanent magnet, like a bar magnet, and put a piece of paper over it and sprinkled finely ground up iron filings. That's basically what most people perceive as magnetic field lines.
QSL. But if you didn't have the book and you had to draw a picture of a magnetic field around a wire, you know, it could be almost anything, don't you think?
Well, it depends on what you mean by almost anything. Magnetic fields, in permanent magnets, a magnetic field is fixed. In electrical circuits, magnetic fields are induced using the right-hand law, and that will give you the general direction of, it's called the curl. The way that Maxwell's theory works for in the induction of both electric and magnetic fields uses the right-hand law and uses an operator called the curl. So what happens is you get a field developing curling around the point of it being induced. So it depends upon how it's induced and the direction it's being induced, but it basically amounts to field lines occurring at right angles to that.
KG2RY. Yeah, but let's say you have a wire. You're going to take a picture of the magnetic field around the wire, the inductance. So you have a wire, you know, and you know that the current is going through the wire and the magnetic field is being somehow produced, but you can't see anything. And if you take a photograph of it, all you're going to get is a picture of a wire.
Well, you have to use a sensory device that detects the thing you're sensing. And a magnetic field is not the same as an electromagnetic field. If you want to pick up a magnetic field, you need a magnetic sensor, such as a Hall device.
KD2WOT.
Yes, WOT.
Good evening, Roy, and everyone. Yeah, I mean, there's something called the right-hand rule. So if you were to wrap your fingers around the wire, the thumb would be pointing in the direction of the current flow, and the fingers would represent the magnetic field around the wire.
But that would make a pretty, it would be a photograph that people could understand.
Okay, but you know, that's something you learn in physics. I mentioned the right-hand rule. Again, if you just sprinkle iron filings, you're going to see the lines of force. There are lots of illustrations. If you go back to the first time that I brought up the point about how transmission of transient signals gets propagated in a circuit, that it goes through electromagnetic waves instead of just through the conductors, one of the parts of that YouTube video is a nice illustration of the magnetic field, the electric field, and the ensuing electromagnetic field that the two produce. So there are illustrations, but our eyes do not perceive magnetism. There are sense organs that can sense magnetic fields. We don't really have one. So we can theorize, we can use the right-hand rule, which demonstrates how it is generated, but we cannot personally perceive it because we're just not designed to. It's sort of like, what do RF waves look like? They don't look like anything to me because I can't see them.
Yeah, but if you wanted to draw a picture, for example, you have a dipole antenna, or you could even say you have a small magnetic loop, and there is signal coming from it. How could you interpret that, you know, in a drawing so that somebody could understand?
Well, again, it sort of depends on what you're trying to illustrate. It's a difficult thing to illustrate because it doesn't really translate into reality. It's like when NASA uses false color to make things more obvious, and then people yell and scream that it's a false color and it doesn't really exist. So you can detect different fields of force using sensory equipment, and then you can draw those lines of force in a overlay and show it as an illustration. It's not something that you're going to visually perceive because we lack sensors to perceive those aspects of physics.
Well, some people, you know, they'll just take the source of the RF or magnetic energy, invisible energy, you know, and they would show the antenna, and then they would have like lines with arrows on them showing that the signal is traveling, you know, from the antenna to some other place.
Okay, but now you got to get a little bit more specific. What you're talking about right now is something specifically called the pointing vector of electromagnetic propagation. Electromagnetic waves propagated right angles to both the magnetic and electric fields. So you could say that the electric field is going up and down in the x-axis, and the magnetic field is going up and down in the y-axis, and the pointer vector is going out in the z-axis. So that would be an illustration for the pointer vector of electromagnetism. It would not be the pointer, it would not be the illustration of either solely the electric field or the magnetic field, but the propagation of the two combined.
Yeah, but this would be an illustration of something that's invisible to the eye. So it could be anything, you know, it could be, you know, if you have a book and a book illustrates, this is what a magnetic field looks like, this is what an RF transmission looks like, you know, you'd be totally lost and you say, well, you know, I want to create my own picture of it.
Okay, but I mean, ultimately, the only thing you can really represent are changes in magnitude over time and distance. Otherwise, you can't kind of decide on the color of electromagnetic waves unless they're in the visible spectrum. Beyond that, they don't have any meaning. And a lot of things are invisible, unfortunately. The voltage potential of a dipole is maximum at the edge of the resonant legs of the dipole. The current is highest at the center feed point of the resonant dipole. Both of those are invisible. You cannot perceive where the voltage is and how strong the voltage is just by looking at it.
There was this photographer who was exhibiting in Chelsea Gallery. He takes this big camera, maybe 20 by 24 inches, and what he does, he puts some paper in the back of it, and then he points it at the sun. And the sun burns lines in the paper. And almost every single artwork that he created, photographic art, you know, where the sun burnt a hole into the paper, it looked like he must have been a ham radio operator, because there looked like the propagation of radio signals.
Well, I am not aware of his work. If you can email me a link, I would love to see it. There are many things in nature that mimic other things in nature. That does not necessarily mean that they're identical, or even in some cases that they're similar, just that they're superficially similar. So I'm not quite sure what method he was using. You know, there's all kinds of interesting tricks. This Curlian photography, where I think at one point they were trying to con people that if you cut a leaf in half, the Curlian photography field for the entire leaf remained. That was more of a factor of the crudity of the technology and cherry-picking the right photograph. There's lots of interesting things that photography does, and there are interesting ways of producing things that sort of look like lightning bolts or other field intensity characteristics, but again, some of them are similar, but some of them just are coincidental.
Yeah, I hear you. And just want to say, like in everything, any place where you're going to learn something, you know, I think it's advantageous for any student to find a really good teacher and stay with them. Learn a heck of a lot, you know. And this guy, you know, when he made his pictures, the sun would move through the sky, you know, as the earth turned. And it would leave a mark, a line to the ionosphere and back down to the horizon on the other side.
Okay. I mean, really, it's traveling from one side of the horizon to the other side of the horizon. It doesn't stop the ionosphere, but yeah, I get the idea.
Yeah, QSL. Yeah, it was pretty cool. And that was actually when I was a student in photography. When I saw that, I said, this is really amazing. I hope, you know, he didn't, like, set a fire on his on the paper. And I guess the question is, you know, what does the propagation of radio signals actually look like? And how can we be sure that the picture that someone is telling us is the actual thing?
Well, once again, these are not true images because we cannot see these things. We have no way of directly perceiving them. You know, I mean, again, don't want to touch onto the philosophical net, but ultimately there's no way that I can convey to you what I see when I'm looking at something green. I'll say it's green. You were taught to look at the same thing and say it's green, but it's within the realm of possibilities that when I'm thinking of green, I'm thinking of something completely different than what you're thinking of green. So there's a lot of those types of qualifiers for things that are communally perceived. When it gets to radio frequencies, it's not communally perceived. It's more of an idealization. You're perceiving an excitation in fields of energy that you have no way of detecting, because then there's nothing built into your system that's capable of doing it. So you can use other equipment and reconstruct what it sort of looks like as intensities fluctuating, but how it looks visually is kind of meaningless because it doesn't look like anything visually because it's not in the visual realm. I mean, if you wanted to upscale it into the visual realm, you could sort of say it kind of vaguely looks the way that light looks, even rainbows look, and all kinds of things. But the nuances are kind of lost on that.
KG2RY. Yeah, well, you know, long ago somebody made a discovery, you know, and he had to explain what it is to people who had no idea about these things, you know. So I had to somehow describe it in terms of a picture so that they would understand. But, you know, it could have been anything.
Well, I mean, this is the great problem of popularizing any technology. In order to explain it to people who don't kind of haven't been able to wrap their head around it as much as the person explaining it, you tend to try and simplify it. And you try to find an analogy in the physical world. When you start to do that, you introduce errors because there's a lot of things that just have no direct relationship with the macroscopic world. When we talk about electron spin, and we've talked about it before on the technical net, I've mentioned before, electrons do not physically spin. They are probably point charge objects. If they spun, the velocities would be far greater than the speed of light, which you can't violate. So we call it a spin because it works very similar to spinning things. But the problem is that if you explain it to too many people as spin, you're left with a lot of people thinking that electrons are spinning like little tops. So the same thing goes with any analogy. Analogies are useful to get a good, vague sense of what's going on. But if you think that it's a one-to-one correlation with reality, unfortunately, it introduces errors into your thoughts.
Well, maybe I'd try to explain it in an easier way. In a long time ago, before radio technology existed, even before a spark generator, way before, you know, and all the way back, none of this existed and none of this technology was there. Maybe a little bit like Leonardo da Vinci invented something or another so and so from the Renaissance days. But all of this had to be created, you know, like the picture of the inductor and what it looks like, you know, in terms of, like, what people can understand, you know. I think that, you know, all of it had to be somehow put together in a number of different people's minds so that it could be developed into some form that people who don't really know can understand.
Well, I mean, this is a common thing that teachers and popularizers do all the time. YouTube is full of people trying to come up with useful analogies that come close but not identical to what's really going on. I would have a little disagreement with what you said earlier, just on a semantic frame of reference. These things were not created. You know, electromagnetism, that's light. Light was there before someone, quote, created it, you know, unless you want to go back to Genesis. I would rather use the term discovered than created, because these underlying things did exist since the dawn of the universe, for the most part. And so we just discovered it. We didn't really create these things.
Yeah, but we had to create the picture so we, in our mind, could know what it is. And maybe the picture isn't a painting or a photograph. Maybe it's just words in a book.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of approximate models that people come out with. Some are verbal, some are graphic. The Bohr model of the atom is very well known. Most people can remember seeing it in their science books when they were kids. It is a simplification. It is not the true case of the atom. Unfortunately, it gives people the sense that atoms are sort of like solar systems, where the nucleus is the sun and the planets are the electrons, and the electrons orbit around the nucleus and they rotate the way that planets do around their own axis while they rotate around the nucleus. That isn't how things happen. Electrons, as I mentioned, don't spin, so there's no spinning on its axis. And they don't really orbit, although unfortunately physicists came up with the term orbital. Not really orbit, but it sounds a lot like orbit, and so a lot of people assume it's orbit. But they don't orbit. They just kind of smear out in a probability wave all over the place.
Yeah, and the atoms are like universes in themselves with billions of universes making up these universes. So, you know, it could be anything, you know, that this big universe could be part of a bigger universe, and that universe also, like many universes, could be part of another bigger universe.
Yes, Wesley recognized. I'll get to you in a second, Wesley. See, that's the problem, though. If you misuse the Bohr model of the atom, you assume that it is very similar to a solar system, and then you can play these philosophical regressions where if you shrink down to the level of the nucleus, which is really a sun, which it isn't, then you could shrink down to something else, and there are infinite regressions down. The reality is that atoms don't look anything like solar systems or galaxies or universes. The nucleus is a relatively really small little thing, and it's basically a package of top and bottom quarks wrapped around some gluons, and, you know, when you shrink down beyond a quark, you get nothing because that's a fundamental particle, so you can't kind of go into another universe, which then goes into another universe, which then goes in another. It's nice, and I like it. It's very poetic. It rhymes. There are nice aspects of it. People had the similar kind of idea about time, where the Big Bang was cyclical at one point. We didn't realize that we're not contracting, we're not slowing down, we're speeding up falling apart. So the idea was that eventually there'll be a big crunch and another big bang, and we'll get a chance at another identical parallel life, and that'll happen again and again and again. So, you know, we've done this before, we're doing it now, and we'll do it again. Sounds wonderful, very philosophically enjoyable, most likely complete nonsense, unfortunately. But I understand why it's an attractive thing. Wesley, you wanted to say something.
Draw me a picture.
I wanted to finish the subject about the antenna that I prepared, because we went far away from it. Unless you think that we are already at the science section and direction.
Not necessarily, Wesley. We just kind of got stuck at a diversion. But if you want to pilot it back to the subject at hand, then feel free.
Okay. So I don't want the unfinished subject. So about the ferrite material and the ferrite antennas, it's not only that those are receiving antennas, they are also a high power transmitting antennas. And my primary concern was why those antennas are not widely used today. Or maybe because the frequency of operation is drifting up and no longer people are interested with the low frequencies. And then the question is why. But before I go to it, I read just another sentence. It is noted that the ferrite material introduced problems not found in air core antennas. As we're trying to compare between those two. Ferrite is hard and brittle. Extremes of temperature affect its characteristic. Hume pickup is possible due to the nonlinear BH curve. Vibration stabilization can be destroyed by exposure to high level of AC or DC flux fields. All those properties, however, are controlled sufficiently well in available ferrites to permit satisfactory operation in portable broadcast band receivers and transmitters. And then the subject of noise, I believe it is quite interesting. When they made in that CIA paper a discussion about the noise, they didn't put in dBs, but actually they were more interested in frequencies, so that would be 25 kilocycles per second. Interesting agent. Good. So the minimum signal that can produce a useful output from a radio receiver is determined by the output signal to the noise ratio for a given signal amplitude. This ratio is set by the external noise entering the receiver via the antenna and by the internal noise generated in the antenna at low-level circuits of the receiver. The antenna-associated circuitry, therefore, is a determining factor in setting the level of optimum signal reception. I'm going to stop in here. It's a little bit more about it. It says about the bandwidth of a right antenna, quite impressive. So they say about 25 kilocycles, so that would be 25 kilohertz frequency, and the bandwidth or pass band is 2 kilocycles. And we know that the single sideband for ham radio is 2.4 kilohertz. So that is even more. Narrow than the low LNB signal band, lower signal band, upper signal band, upper sideband, I'm sorry, upper sideband or lower sideband of the single SSB. So the important in here is really in this article, very nicely made tables and the characterization of noise sources, which I actually didn't see in many papers. Here you have it, everything listed. So the atmospheric storms, cosmic, extraterrestrial radiation, man-made static, precipitation static, radiation resistance, which would be the thermal, and that would be all the externally generated, but with internally generated noise sources, we have antenna ohmic resistor, which would be thermal. Interesting. I would like Dr. Royce to say something about it. We're talking about ohmic resistance of an antenna that would cause the generation of the noise? Kind of, I don't know. Then we have a coupling circuit resistance, which is also thermal. And we have amplifier and mixer short noise. Okay, that's, but what do you, Dr. Roy, understand by antenna ohmic resistance in parentheses thermal? What that has to do with and to exchange?
Well, I don't know for a fact. I would assume that talking about the injection of noise based on the thermal aspect of the antenna. We kind of talked about that either last week or the week before, that there are some radio systems that are cooled to very low temperatures because the temperature of the circuitry and the antenna and such introduces further noise. As far as I'm aware, the ferrite loops, as you mentioned earlier, were and are very popular on broadcast AM because they were effective for the very, very low frequency, and because locally the amount of energy being broadcast was so great that the inherent inefficiencies of that design were not a problem. You know, eventually, you know, and a lot of people want to transmit it at frequencies in amateur radio. So having antennas optimized for reception only is problematic. That doesn't mean that people don't use and love beverage antennas and things similarly, but they also prefer something that can be transmitted. And if you're going to have something that has an inherent high impedance, you're going to have an effective problem transferring received power, and it's going to be impossible to use for transmissions.
Thank you for that. The impedance of free space is 366 ohms, if I remember correctly. But here we have something new. And it's old paper. No chance for error. It was scrutinized, it was paid for, and it was for ECIA. I'm going to read that. It says about the atmospheric electrical storms and electrostatic disturbances as the one of the reasons for noises, the externally generated noise, but it says there's two sources generate noise signals which are basically different. The former gives rise of true radiation field in which the electric and magnetic field intensities are related by the characteristic impedance of free space, which is, Dr. Roy, 120 ohms. Let me go further. The later on the hand, it is near field phenomenon, for which the E field and H field intensities are related by the factor of which is a function of frequency and which is far greater than 120 ohms. For the frequencies below 1.5 megacycle, in effect, therefore, the electrostatic disturbances in the region of 25 kilocycles per second are primary electric field noise signals. If you could explain to me the characteristic impedance of free space, 120 ohms. Who's right, who's wrong? It should be 266. Or maybe 399, no, 366, if I remember. Dr. Ray.
Well, I mean, one thing to kind of point out is just because it was written by the CIA doesn't necessarily mean it was accurate or that it was true or that it was real. I would review it with other literature at hand just to ensure its veracity. The good old CIA back in those days did all kinds of interesting things, including doping subjects with LSD just to kind of see what they would do in real life until one of them jumped out of a window. So, yeah, CIA is kind of a tricky along those ways.
DDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I think they may have dropped a pi out of that. Impedance of free space is 120 pi ohms. I think they may have left out the pi. I always remember the impedance of free space is the same as the omega of 60 cycles.
Yes, you're right. I didn't see it. The 120 pi. That's correct. Okay. My fault. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, and for the rest of us, it's basically 377.
Okay, so it's not 366, 377. Thank you. Okay. So that we have at least correct. Now, I have a problem with you saying, yeah, well, the CIA was doing this and that. No. You write to the point of a certain experiment of FBI, CIA, and all of those agencies, but then at the end of that article, we have in that sanitized copy for CIA, we have references. And the references says, Third Edition Federal Telephone and Radio Corporation, data for radio engineers. Then we have the Atwood SS, the electric magnetic field by John Wheely and Sons. And that's from 1949. So we would say that in 1957, they were thinking about some material, at least they were advised, some material is a good standing model in physics and practical experience. Then they have aerial effect in receiving sets in loop aerials by Phillips. And then we have another one by Phillips, technical review, which would be inductive aerials in modern broadcast receivers, and that was modern, of course, in 1955. And we have three more. Van Nostrand CO Incorporated, I saw some of their products. The ferrite cord antennas for broadcast band receivers. That is, I don't know the guy. I don't know the Gearmet CA. And then was the last one was Goldman. That was frequency analysis, modulation, and noise. That was from 1948. by Mark Grofield Hill. Yeah. Good literature. Some of it I'm familiar with. Some of it I'm not. When I look at the problem, technical problem, I look from history standpoint and changes of it, and eventually that gives me the advantage of understanding what's wrong and what good and what was before. Thank you for mentioning the Bohr model of atom. And that is the best example of the evolution, or historical evolution, and eventually some of the errors aside to that, because people like the old model better. Anyhow, thank you very much. That's it. There is another link that I'm going to send of the Japanese bipolar antenna, bipolar antenna. I don't see the bipolar word associated with antennas, but what the heck. Thank you very much, and I give you microphone back, Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Wesley. Thanks for all this information. Again, I just want to kind of mention that we have to try as best we can not to give certain sources of information a level of infallibility. We're trying the best we can, the best and the brightest, and we poor folks, to kind of give explanations as best we can, and models that seem to work as best it can. There are always better models, better explanations, and underlying things that don't reveal themselves for many, many, many years. So just because you read it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. It means it might be true. Always seek other reference sources and come to a conclusion based on some critical thinking and some multiple references. Otherwise, if you just decide that something has all the truths in it, then you're just reading from the Bible. So thanks again, Wesley. It's 9:53. I guess this would be a good time to open up the general discussion of science in general. Any topics of interest, we'll give it a try. Again, we caution you, we do not diagnose nor treat over the radio, but if you want to talk about the Omicron variant or anything akin, this is a good time.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I read the article. It was the first one on your website for tonight about the Omicron, and they gave their information about what they thought about it. I wonder if you agree with it or don't. I'm just wondering what you think. How bad is this going to be? They were talking about the speed of the Omicron, when it gets into your bronchial tubes, it starts heading down your bronchial tubes. They said it goes real, real fast. And then the good news is that when it gets to your lungs, it's not as deadly as the Delta. It doesn't kill off your lung cells as quick as the Delta does. But, bad news and good news. Wonder what you think about that, and back to you, Roy. WS1.
AC2GS. Sure. I'd love to make a comment. You have to keep in mind, once again, that this is all very preliminary. None of these studies have been peer-reviewed. They have not been formally published. They are out on servers for people to take a look at and address and comment upon. So it is within the realm of possibilities that our understanding shifts and changes over time. This is not because people like Anthony Fauci is an idiot, but simply because truth takes some time to figure out completely. So that in mind, the Omicron variant is a very weird variant. It appears to be more infectious than even the Delta, and it seems to end up, it looks like it's going to surmount the Delta variant in most populations. So far, it does not quite seem to be as deadly as the Delta and the earlier ones. Now, that may turn out to be statistical happenstance because it's been detected in far more younger, less at-risk people. This is because of how vaccinations sort of work. Let me drop for a sec. Number one, fortunately for us, RNA vaccines that most of us have, if you've had the Johnson & Johnson or you've had the Moderna, seem to provide a great deal more protection than the more classical viral vaccines that the rest of the world has gotten, the Russian vaccine and the Chinese vaccine, and even the Johnson & Johnson vaccine uses somewhat older technology, and it apparently is less effective for the variants. So if you got yourself the Moderna and or the Pfizer, you're in reasonably good shape. You should get the booster still because the booster will give you an additional advantage. None of these things gives you 100% protection against getting any of the viruses. It does limit your risk a great deal, and if, despite that, you still become infected, it limits the possibility of it turning into a much more virulent, dangerous illness that gets you in the hospital. So you should get the boosters. And the concept behind people who had the vaccine and the booster wearing masks is that there's a small chance of you having an asymptomatic or very mild infection, but you can then give a full-blown infection to people around you who have chosen not to be properly vaccinated and boosted. So that's the reason for the face mask requirements. It's going to be very problematic for the rest of the world because most of the world was vaccinated with the classical type of vaccine, which apparently is less effective. We're coming to the cold weather and the holidays where everyone gets together and violates all the social distancing. So you're going to see some degree of a peak of activity. I hope that it doesn't translate to quite the same amount of hospitalizations, but you're going to see it's sort of inevitable. And the rest of the world is probably going to take it on the chin more than us simply because, thankfully, we have the messenger RNA technology in our vaccines. Any questions?
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
I thought the W2VL repeater was going to ask you a question for you. Okay, no, yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, we'll see. I just hope it doesn't get very bad where we bring back the COVID nets. Remember, last year when it's really bad, we had the COVID nets on this repeater. And I just don't think it's going to get that bad. I hope not. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I hope not. There were a lot of dubious suggestions from participants who just kind of wandered in and were pushing unapproved over-the-counter and veterinary medicines and such. I think everyone kind of knows the right things to do and the wrong things to do. Again, I think a good portion of our population has thankfully had either the Moderna or the Pfizer two series and the booster. So they're as protected can be. If there is breakthrough, it will most likely be very, very mild flu-like symptoms that won't go beyond that point. So I'm kind of locally very optimistic. Nationwide, not so much, because there are still large pockets of people who deny things and resist things, and they're not properly vaccinated. And unfortunately, we have yet to really discern what happens when you let Omicron loose on an unvaccinated population. How many of them